What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are conversations from the Pointed Firs, invoking the spirit of place with artists and authors from Maine.
I'm Peter Neal, host of Conversations from the Pointed Firs, an hour-long interview with authors, artists, neighbors, and friends whose life and work evoke the spirit of Maine. Heard the first Friday of every month at 4 p.m. here on WERU Community Radio, the voice of many voices. What is the unique history that binds us together? What are the values and behaviors shaped by our special landscape that represent the best of our creativity, resilience, and special quality of mind? How do we understand and celebrate the spirit of this place through the accomplishments of those with whom we live? Sarah Orne Jewett published her American classic, The Country of the Pointed Firs, in 1896, and it has remained a quiet evocation of the best of Maine. In a special edition published by Simon & Schuster, it is described as follows. It tells the story spanning 3 months' time in the life of a small coastal town called Dunnet Landing in 19th century Maine. A lone female visitor arrives and finds lodging with the widow Mrs. Todd, the town herbalist who introduces the visitor to many of the town's inhabitants. The visitor's impressions of these people she meets start out simply, and then they almost invisibly crescendo into a deep, intense human portrait. When I read this book, I am moved by the wisdom hidden in the simplicity of the story, the portraits of the people, the likes of whom today are my friends and neighbors, known and unknown. For Jewett, the place described is a best scape for living, in nature, at work, for community. It is a place to see, hear, smell, taste, feel, love, and celebrate the best of what we call home. At the end, Jewett writes, near the woods, we could walk along the highest point, there above the circle of pointed firs. We could look down over all the island and could see the ocean that circled this and 100 other bits of island ground, the mainland shore and all the horizons. It gave a sudden sense of space, for nothing stopped the eye or hedged one in. That sense of liberty in space and time, which great prospects always give. Liberty in space and time. What a perfect definition for the spirit of Maine. This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guest today is Peter Ralston, photographer and narrator of the special identity of Maine's islands and coastal villages, whose artistic career and inspirational photographs have spanned the coast of Maine and contributed to the understanding and preservation of Maine's working waterfronts and coastal villages as a visual evocation of the spirit of Maine. Peter Ralston.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Peter, it's a pleasure.
Peter DeMeter, here we are. Here we go. I usually start at the beginning, from which you came, how you came, to Maine, if that's the case. Where did it all begin?
I grew up in Chatsford, Pennsylvania, on the banks of the Brandywine River. My parents, in 1957, bought part of an old Quaker mill property. And the next year, Andy and Betsy Wyeth bought the other part of that property. I grew up right on the river next to them. They were 2 minutes away.
That was an accident.
This is straight out of Forrest Gump.
Right.
It was meant to be.
Meant to be.
I mean, it was meant to be. Great neighbors. I had a crush on Betsy Wyeth when I was 9 years old. And it was pure serendipity, or was it? Among other things, there were three islands in the Brandywine River. There, the way the river was dammed up with two waterfalls to supply water to the late 18th century flour mill. And that's where I fell in love with islands. There was something from get-go about being on them with my dog, little boat. So there was that. It was a big element. But then there was Andy and Betsy. And my family did not summer in Maine at all. obviously the Wyeths did. So they'd come back every fall and out of the Jeep, and then over the years it sort of got a little fancier, but out would come these paintings that Andy had done the summer before. And they were fascinating. I mean, paintings that you'd recognize, that a lot of people would recognize. And along with the paintings were the stories. The Wyeths, you know, really starting with N.C., Andy's father, and then all Andy ever did and all Jamie's ever done is paint the story of their lives.
Jamie being Andy's son.
One of Andy's two sons, yeah. And brilliance ran three generations deep in that family. So they'd come back from Maine. Here would be these paintings of this place. I didn't know anything. In my child's mind's eye, the paintings were spectacular, but the stories, the Wyeths never let truth get too much in the way of a good story. So there would be colorful stories about pirate fishermen and skullduggery and who was doing well. Anyway, colorful stuff. So in my child's mind's eye, I conflated Maine, you know, some place really exotic, way north, you know, way, way north. And after a brief, fast forward, late teens, a brief and spectacularly unsuccessful academic career, mm-hmm. and there were plans for me and this and that.
We'll leave this unspoken.
Well, there's not a whole lot to talk about anyway. there were plans for me, but I wanted to be a photographer.
How'd you know you wanted to be a photographer?
Indeed. So this is back before we had any glowing screens. I remember when we got our first black and white TV. I'm actually old enough to say that. My God.
Me too.
But it was magazines. Magazines were the thing. And our mother inculcated, and myself and two younger brothers, a passion, a love for reading. So there was this storytelling thing going on. Next door, there was Andy painting away. And there were a lot of N.C. Wyeth paintings over there. Swashbuckling, storytelling. But the real heart of it for me were the magazines. And this was the heyday of Life magazine and National Geographic. And my God, you mean to tell me that people get to go around the world and see these places and get paid to photograph?
Life magazine was one thing, but National Geographic was something quite different. And if you were interested in current affairs and all the rest of it, life was your vehicle. Yeah. But if you were interested in romance, place that you never could even imagine exist, National Geographic, the yellow box was your doorway. I mean, the photographs were always brilliant. The stories were accessible, and you could read them without any hesitation whatsoever. And it took you far away. I've heard so many times people tell me how National Geographic formulated their whole way of looking at the world.
Oh, yeah. But just as much, so too did Life. Yeah. Gordon Parks, Kosti Rahoma, you know, on and on and on. I mean, great, great, great photographers were telling stories, and they were grittier stories sometimes. You know, but it's all storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was, I don't know, it just took early that storytelling, that's the life for me, and I didn't know. And along come the late 60s, and I was something of a freewheeling spirit. School, and maybe not so much, and I had the camera, and I'd been interested in photography for a while, and had encouragement at home, encouragement from Andy and Betsy, who would let me sit around and sort of be a fly on the wall with them. They often called me their third son, but I'd sort of crumbs from that great table, and I'd hear them talk about the paintings and what got Andy's interest. They'd talk about the titles and this and that. It was all just such rich stuff. I didn't want to go to school. I wanted to be out there playing storyteller. So I had a little Pentax Spotmatic, two lenses, and I started, you know, I would do anything to sort of get by as a photographer. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've done weddings. Yes, I've done, you know, sort of stuff for local newspapers, but it grew and grew, and I'm not shy. You figured that out by now. And
I think the audience has probably figured it out by now, too. It's only been 7 minutes.
Anyway, I sort of bootstrapping myself along. Then there were regional magazines, local magazines. And I wasn't afraid to go to magazines, do my homework, figure out what they were all about. This was not National Geographic, and it wasn't Life, not at that point. But I would go to art directors and propose stories, and I'd show them a little sheet of slides or later tear sheets from other magazines. And I was fairly self-confident, riddled with doubt inside, but I really wanted to do this thing, and that's what I went for.
So did you make is that how you made your early living?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Ansel Adams used to photograph women's lingerie for San Francisco department stores. Mm-hmm. You know, Andy's done stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you do what you got to do.
Right.
For a while, I drove a truck for Agway. Mm-hmm. I was a technical writer for a little while. Mm-hmm. I was smart enough I could sort of flim-flam my way in, you know, all sorts of things, but it was always the photography. It was always storytelling.
So how then did the transition to Maine occur?
There's the life changer right there. So I had been working as a photojournalist for maybe a decade or so. It was 1978. 20 years after I first met Andy and Betsy. I think at the time they saw me with this photojournalism like a flat rock skipping across a pond, you know, going far, fast, but never deep. And Andy, real storytelling is about going deep, deep. And they decided to bring me to Maine. We were having dinner with them one night at their house. This is Chad's Ford. Betsy points at me and says, "You are coming to Maine with us this summer. We're going to give you the guest house on the farm in Cushing. It's time." And I came up to Maine that summer with them. We're here for 6 months, my wife and I, and driving around with Andy in the Jeeps. You know, he was introducing me to the people that you would recognize in the paintings and places that he painted, and going around with Betsy in the boat. And that, 1978, was the summer she bought her first of what became three serious islands. Those little islands in the Brandywine were one thing. But here she, the sorceress, had an accomplice to play with her, work with her, be there, as she got into first a small island, 22 acres, in the mouth of Tenants Harbor, and then the two bigger islands off Port Clyde.
Did she have a vision then as to what those islands were going to be?
Yeah. Betsy always had a vision. Always. You know, it's like when Andy got a fresh tempera panel or a fresh sheet of paper. I mean, there it was. And he knew he could do things with it. And visions evolve. They change. They morph. The island Betsy bought in the mouth of Tenants Harbor had a lighthouse on it that hadn't been lived in. It was getting kind of funky around the edges, decrepit, and whatnot. She fixed it up, and you bet she had a vision. A great part of Betsy's genius, one of the greatest roles she played in their lives together, was she would create the worlds in which they lived. And nothing about it was artificial. It wasn't colonial Williamsburg, you know, with velvet ropes, do not touch, you know, this and that. No, it was hands-on living. And there was the mill. I mean, who buys a 18th century mill and fixes it up at enormous expense and whatnot? Betsy did, and Andy painted it. The farm in Cushing, Southern Island in Tenants Harbor with a lighthouse on it, and then the two larger islands 6 miles due south of Port Clyde. Betsy had a unique vision. She was every bit as brilliant as Andy, every single bit. And she was a storyteller, except instead of using paint and pencil and paper and tempera panels, she used crews of men and fire and bulldozers and hydraulics and this and that. She was not afraid to think big.
I've always thought, though, that all that work underneath it all was carefully covered over, in the sense that what was left behind and which Andrew Wyeth captured was the clarity of those places. They weren't precious. They were fixed up. They had somewhat, at the beginning at least, lost their patina, but that patina returned. I've always had a sense that this wasn't an exercise in decoration.
Oh, God,
this
no.
was a this was an exercise in restoration, a kind of one way of evoking the return of the authentic, something, whatever the words are. It was never, it seemed to me, overdone, which I think accounts for the value of the places and the emotional content that is derived by the participants, by the viewers.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming online and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Peter Ralston, photographer and narrator, whose artistic career and inspirational photographs have spanned the coast of Maine and contributed to the understanding and preservation of Maine's working waterfronts and coastal villages as a visual evocation of the spirit of Maine.
Betsy was basically like a brilliant, brilliant little girl, all grown up, who had a vision. And she was every bit as imaginative, creative, driven as Andy. And she had, you know, some money to work with. I've named the places that she made her worlds. They were Andy's worlds. And all Andy ever did was paint. He never painted more than a couple of miles from where they lived, a couple of miles from his various studios in Chatsford or Maine. And he painted what he knew and what he loved and what intrigued him. And so Betsy, this brilliant girl with an extraordinary sort of architectural sensibility, aesthetic sensibilities. She would build buildings. She would bring buildings off the mainland and barge them out to the islands. And that's what Andy painted. I mean, he would go off of their properties, paint lots of other people, but never too far. It was all drilling into his life.
So what was your role in that first part of the development of the islands? You were her amanuensis. You were you documented all of this work.
Documentation of it all was really incidental. Mm-hmm. So she brought, you know, up I came in 1978. She bought Southern Island. You know, I have pictures of us, all of us out there, you know, sort of digging with trowels, you know, finding the old flagstones that, you know, earlier lightkeepers had buried and stuff. Now, she had crews that were doing the work. And, I mean, she was playing me. You know, I had played on her islands as a little kid. Now she was in the island business in a big way, in a fantastical way. And Southern was one thing. I've always thought of Southern Island, you know, you can really swim out to it from Tenants. It's a magical, strange place. It was John Fowlesian. But I look back on it as almost a pre-study, a major pre-study. You know, Tampa is done, literally done out there and whatnot. But she was building up to something much bigger. And that was in 1980 when Allen Island, 450 acres, due 6 miles due south of Port Clyde, came on the market, and Betsy went for it. She tracked me down the day the lawyer came up from Wilmington, Delaware, to Chatsford, and no cell phones then. She tracked me down and said, it's done. The ink's dry. What the hell am I going to do with an island the size of Monhegan? You got me into this, because I had been encouraging her. I would say, no. I mean, this is adventure written all over it. Go for it. Go for it. You got me into this. Help me out with this, and the island is yours in all but title. Well, she was playing me, and I knew that she knew that I knew she was playing me, but this was adventure. This was adventure.
What did that mean? What did she actually expect you to do?
You know, none of us knew at that point. It was go out there and let's figure it out. Mm-hmm. And so Alan, this fabulous, beautiful island, had gone feral. At one point, there was a year-round community out there in Maine. Parenthetically, there were once 300 year-round islands. Today, there are but 15 year-round islands. Alan had a school out there. There's a store. The whole nine yards, but it, like so many others, 285 others, it had sort of flickered out for a variety of reasons. It had really gone feral. The old fields had grown in. There were a couple of fishermen on Allen from Friendship living out there. It was really, really pretty basic. No electric, I mean, no nothing. But it was out in the fishing grounds. So this is ancestral fishing grounds for a lot of people. And then right next door was Benner Island. Same deal. All the old buildings were crumbling and falling apart and whatnot. So we fetched up there. And Betsy didn't have a 100% clear vision. It was in there. And the idea was, ultimately, let's clear some land and let's build some buildings
and let fishermen stay. From day one, it was all about this would be the exception to the rule. Rich summer people come along, buy some working waterfront or non-working, and the first thing that goes every time are the fishermen. Get them out of here. The bait stinks, you know, loud rock and roll or country western, you know, at 3:30 and then 4 o'clock in the morning every day, you know, the fishermen got to go. Au contraire. Now, keep in mind, Betsy's father-in-law and Sea Wyeth, her husband, Andy, and her son, Jamie, had been painting waterfront, been painting Port Clyde and Monhegan and the islands, Teal's Island, just over the way a little bit. And this intrigued Betsy. Betsy was tough. You know, she could hold her own with any of them. You know, she had a vision of let's build another home out there. But this home can embrace and encompass others, including the fishermen. So they aren't going anywhere. Betsy knew perfectly well that right there is the confluence of, you know, St. George fishermen, Friendship fishermen, Cushing fishermen, and that's where their bottom all came together. And she could give them a place where they could keep fishing.
And, they could fish from it, not necessarily live on the island, but fish from it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Yeah. So while this is all going on, you're there with your little Pentax.
Well, it wasn't that I was photographing it. I was, you know, the sorcerer's accomplice. I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't go far without a camera. I was beyond Pentax at that point. You know, I've been photographing, you know, professionally for a decade. But it was a great adventure and one of the absolute best things happened really early. I think it was 1980. I heard about this guy named Conkling, Philip Conkling. And the first time I wrote it down, I spelled both names wrong. Philip had been working with Outward Bound as a sort of consulting naturalist to Outward Bound, which had a place on many islands, including they were headquartered over on Hurricane Island off Fine Haven. And Philip had actually been the one assigned, if you will, by Hurricane Island Outward Bound School to go show Mrs. Wyeth this island that's for sale. Outward Bound was motivated by this being a place where they could have solo sites. And there had been talk of Allen Island, which was for sale. I think it was for $500,000 or maybe it was $1 million. Yeah, it was $1 million. You know, for McMansions, a golf course, it would have ruined all of Muscungus Bay.
Right.
It would have killed it. I know that was on Betsy's mind. But more than that, this was an opportunity for her to do some storytelling, some mm-hmm. creative work mm-hmm. in her medium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not with paint, mm-hmm. not with pencil or any of that. Her rules, her way, my baseball, my bat, my glove, my field. And my God, she went at it. So early on that first summer, I heard about Philip Conkling. Betsy said, let's get him out here. Philip came out. We met. We hit it off. Crazy immediately. There was a shared vision, a shared sense of, you know, here's an opportunity too. This is going to be fun. This is going to be adventure. Betsy was an adventure unto herself. And it was there on Allen Island, in addition to becoming, you know, this multi-decade performance of Betsy's, her greatest masterpiece, off the charts. Philip and I got together and we started kicking around ideas. And as we were learning more about islands and, you know, I'm so green. I was like green bottom paint behind my ears. I was dripping wet, but got to be pretty fair with boats. We started seeing more, learning more. The more we learned about the island communities, the more intrigued we were, the better we realized that these are rare places. I had traveled enough. Philip had traveled enough to understand that these year-round island communities really are extraordinarily rare, special, amazing places, and they needed friends. So here we are, two guys from away. Are you kidding? We're not only from away, we're from off-island wherever we went. But the two of us with another guy over in Vinyl Haven, there were a few of us around at that point, conceived of. It was really Philip's stroke of genius to maybe start an organization. 501c3, we call it the Island Institute, to be a friend to help sustain, help the islands sustain themselves. And that was the Island Institute, which we formally started in 1983.
Headquartered where it is today, in Rockland?
We started in Rockland, Rockland being smack in the middle of the coast, if you snap a line from Kittery to, you know, Eastport. there's Penobscot Bay. Rockland was a logical choice for us. Rockland was, you know, pretty much on the skids at that point. The ground fishery had died, and Rockland was in tough shape back then. It was starting to perk up a little bit.
So what you have here is a paradoxical moment. You have the culture threatened, conditions changing, natural conditions changing, social conditions changing. Here come folk from away, and they engage in not colonialism, but in a kind of cultural conservation exercise, which involves, yes, buying some islands and preserving them, but also creating an institution with that purpose in mind, that the cultural aspects, which includes the fisheries and all the associated familial and performative values of an island culture, could be also sustained, conserved.
Well, we didn't buy islands. We were never a land acquisition.
You advocated for them, right?
Well, environmentalism and protection of land and so forth was of interest. Maine is blessed with a wealth of great land conservation organizations. That was never our deal. We were really about the communities, really about people. And that's where we played. I mean, the island communities have been here for a long time. Why, two guys from away, what are they going to do for us? Oh, my God, the suspicion. At best, there was suspicion when we first started up the Institute. What the hell are these guys all about? What's their scam? What are they after? What do they want? What are they going to tell us? And they all had a point. But our stated mission was to help sustain. And we learned early. Listen, and then listen some more, and then listen some more. So as you mentioned, you know, there are so many components to community, and in these sort of still largely maritime-based communities, fisheries, school, housing, transportation, on and on and on. But the islands were all sort of pretty much on their own. There wasn't much back and forth. There was very little communications, umpteen cases of people who lived on an island and never in their lives had set foot on an island that they could see this side of the horizon. Lots of cases of that. And we just had the temerity to think maybe we could help. And what it was really all about, having traveled and seen a lot of saltwater America, and knowing, and this all goes back to the storytelling for both Philip and me, there were cultures elsewhere, saltwater America, where there had once been real maritime-based, resource-based communities, tight communities, tight. And but they had that had all gone away. I mean, Nantucket, my God, at one point, look what I'm telling you, Nantucket was one of the great maritime hubs on this planet. You know, the whalers were going out from there, and there are umpteen other examples like this. And now, you know, they're gentrified. They're unrecognizably gentrified. And there's no evil in that. But the prospect of seeing, the very thought of seeing this world that I had been introduced to and had an immediate, deep, deepest passion for, this raging affair with this new place that had found me through Andy and Betsy, to see it all become, with all due respect, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, the Hamptons, Hilton Head, on and on and on and on. These were rare places, and they needed friends.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming online and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Peter Ralston, photographer and narrator, whose artistic career and inspirational photographs have spanned the coast of Maine and contributed to the understanding and preservation of Maine's working waterfronts and coastal villages as a visual evocation of the spirit of Maine. What would be the first measure of success of the Island Institute? When did you know that you actually could do what you claimed to do?
Well, that took a while. One measure, this is a funny one, but honest to goodness, it's true. Philip ended up in Augusta one time giving some sort of, I can't remember the specifics, some testimony about something. And a state legislator, you know, some guy from up country, looked at him and said, "You mean to tell me there are people who live out in them islands all year?" You know, one of the things, there's no order in any of this. We didn't know what we were doing when we started. We cobbled together a little business plan. We started showing up on the different islands and saying, "Yeah, we're from away, we're from off island. We're calling ourselves the Island Institute, and if we can help in any way, shape, form." And of course, this was met with, you know, basically a solid wall of skepticism and suspicion and more. But we would show up. We were like the Maytag guy, you know, waiting for the phone to ring. I don't know how many of our listeners remember the Maytag guy.
Plenty of them do.
Waiting for the phone to ring. Mm. So we purported to be interested in all the things I've mentioned, all the aspects of community that I've mentioned. And if there was a chance to get involved with anything, you know, we were sort of Johnny on the spot. We'd go there. And slowly but surely, we began to demonstrate that we could actually be useful, be helpful. This came slowly. I can tell you this came very slowly. But the word began to get around, you know, up and down the coast, on the islands. Yeah, they're from away, they're from off island, blah, blah. But by God, they actually got this
Did
and that done for
Did you begin to
us.
Have allies aboard, sort of members of the community who said, "Wait a minute"?
Yes, it came slowly. And honestly, first it was largely, not entirely, but largely summer people. Mm-hmm. One of the great things Betsy did was when we showed her our business plan, she said, "Philip, you know how to write. Peter, you know what you're doing with the camera. I see and hear that you're going to publish and you're going to sort of aid and abet some networking between the islands. You're going to have some sort of publication." She said, "For God's sake, don't just do some mimeographed, self-congratulatory
newsletter
broadside." Mm. She said, "Do something excellent. Do something really, really, really well." And she incented us by giving us 10 of Andy's limited edition prints to sell. She said, "If you do this well, I'll give you these prints." That gave birth to the Island Journal, which came out in 1984. And we cobbled that together. And Philip took half the print run. We bet two-thirds of our first year's annual operating budget on the journal. Mm. And Philip put half the print run in his truck, and I put half in mine. I went down east. He went, you know, to the western of Rockland pushing these things. And it kind of got us almost up on planes, certainly in the summer community where there was some money. And we played to passion for place. So we were getting memberships. We were getting some people. I mean, we had some wonderful writing in there. It was a balance of art and science and storytelling and community. And it took. It amazed us. It took. And from there, slowly but surely, it grew. A couple years after that, we started the Working Waterfront, our monthly newspaper, which I think now is, or it has been for some time, the third largest distribution newspaper in Maine. Go figure. So it was communications, and slowly but surely in the year-round community, the working community, you know, the heart of what we were really all about. First, a couple meetings. You know, we'd go to a few meetings. We'd kind of invite ourselves. Then we got invited, and then we were welcome into more meetings. And slowly, boats would open to us, and wharves would open to us, and then homes would open, and ultimately, hearts opened. And we got a reputation for, we would show up, and we really accomplished a lot of good.
So one of the things that Island Institute continues to do today is a kind of a replication of the formula by selecting young people as island fellows and putting them into the island communities for a period of time with some kind of shared project that's beneficial to everybody, that advances the idea of an island culture, island science, island sociology, whatever those may be, but there are 10 or 12 of them every year, and they've been doing it for 10 or 15 years. And so you've got a whole cadre of young people who are sort of inculcated by the island experience themselves and become parts of the community. I've always wondered, if Island Institute traces those people and tries to survey and evaluate what was retained by the experience, including do they have any relationships with the island after they leave?
If they leave. Yeah, great question, Peter. So the original concept, which was neither Phillips nor mine, it was somebody who was on the staff, great idea. It was basically like an island Peace Corps, if you will. And again, it goes back to listening, listening, listening. And so we would, when we proposed this, we would speak to the island communities, the leaders. And, you know, this year, I believe, I'm right on this, is the 25th year of the Island Fellows Program. And it's one of the things, it was really a hit out of the park. We would listen to the island leaders. You know, what do you need out there? How can we be useful? It was always, how can we be useful? But in this case, elbow grease sometimes is in short supply. And everybody, especially in the small island communities and some of the small peninsular towns, everybody's stretched thin because, you know, people wear so many different hats. Well, if there's a need and it's wanting, and we would supply a young, eager, bright person to go out and dedicate themselves for a year to live on the island, and it worked so well. It was over the top. And in addition to, you know, sort of a check in the plus column for the Institute, the fellows really accomplished some wonderful work. And to your point, a number of them fell in love, I mean, literally and figuratively, on the islands. I mean, there are umpteen fellows who ended up marrying into the islands, who are now island leaders, you know, on the school boards, on the select boards, or what have you, mm-hmm. who have kids now mm-hmm. in the school. Mm-hmm. So this was not a plan by the Institute to take over the islands. We heard that one once. My God, they're going to come out here. That's how they're going to get us.
They're going to marry all our children.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an invasion at the border. No, it was well conceived. We managed to pull it off and pull it off well. There was a lot of buy-in, and I know all of us are really pleased and quietly, humbly proud of what the fellows have been able to do.
Well, two things about the Island Institute. There is a major anniversary. I think it's this year. I was just looking at the annual report, and I was somewhat astonished by the asset value. There's a kind of capital reserve that allows for the island, I think, to a kind of capital reserve that has accumulated over the years, which is a tribute to the confidence that some people have put into the island's success and to enable it to go forward, which is hard for many organizations these days post-COVID, where many, many not-for-profits have lost their way, lost their financial basis, and all the rest. When I read it, I was sort of astonished, and I ruled
You're talking about actual capital.
I'm talking about money in the bank.
Yeah.
And I don't want to diminish the need in any way, but this is responsible that they've been able to convince people of the value of the thing, and so that the first resistance, whether some of it may remain or not, doesn't really matter. The fact is that there is an acceptance built into and capitalized in a way so that this can go
forward. Keep going. Yeah.
And I noticed there's a change in management, for example. So Philip retired as the director. You have retired from that. So there's now new leadership. And I can begin to sense a slightly different nuance in how the Island Institute is going to evolve. Let's assume that the values are the same. And because as soon as the values change, all that other part will disappear.
Mm-hmm.
It will be of no use anymore, and people will turn away.
So for, I think it was 20-some years, we operated with absolutely zero in the bank. There was no endowment, you know, none. we had a little bit of earned income, but it was all memberships. And that's how we operated. And as Philip and I were both getting a little longer in the tooth, and we knew we wouldn't be there forever. We had put in a lot of 100-hour weeks over the years. We had families, and we and the board decided it was time to have our first capital campaign, and we raised. It was extraordinary. I'm still moved by it because this was all 2008. The market had crashed, gone to hell, and we raised. It was $21 million in a tough time, which really spoke to not to how good we were at raising money. I think it really spoke to belief in our mission and what we purported to do and accomplishments, but it also spoke to passion for place. And I think we've always played to that. And this is true whether you're a worm digger from wherever or one of the big houses in Islesboro or Seal Harbor or whatever, there is a passion for this place.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming online and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Peter Ralston, photographer and narrator, whose artistic career and inspirational photographs have spanned the coast of Maine and contributed to the understanding and preservation of Maine's working waterfronts and coastal villages as a visual evocation of the spirit of Maine.
So we raised a lot of money. It was great. That enabled Philip and I to feel pretty good. I left the Institute in 2010. I was pretty burned out after helping to raise all that money, and Philip in 2012.
But hasn't there been yet another shift in leadership? Because that's what I'm beginning to sense, that there's a slight adjustment, nuance to the mission, primarily in terms of an incentive to move further down east and to become a little bit more fully involved in sort of larger issues that pertain to the preservation of the working waterfront.
Well, we started that's a very interesting question. We were the ones that really twigged onto the whole working waterfront situation. The coast of Maine is something like, if you add up every inch of saltwater influenced coastline, it's 3,500, 3,400 plus miles. 20 miles, less than 20 miles, is working waterfront. Now, that's the real endangered entity on the coast of Maine, with all due respect to the right whales and whatever else. If the working waterfront goes, there goes the culture that we know here.
Not only the culture, but that's one of the three greatest revenue producers for the state of Maine.
Yeah, indeed.
In many dimensions.
You back out the working waterfront, and all of a sudden, it's Nantucket, it's Martha's Vineyard, it's Hilton Head, et cetera, with all due respect to those wonderful places. So, we really went to work on that and had the Maine Constitution, state constitution changed and started a working waterfront program that has now gone out and been replicated elsewhere. And
tell me about the state constitution.
I can't give you the details, oh dear, but there was something in the Constitution that was changed to allow, I think, different taxable recognition of working waterfront. Mm-hmm. But it was all about recognizing the absolute significance and importance of that.
You retired from that. You're still a professional photographer. You have the gallery in Rockport. You have a new book coming. And I looked at the table of contents of that book. And I'd like you to talk about that, about the evolution of that. Some of the topics that are in here are pretty interesting because they're themed. They're specific in some cases, like fisheries and waterfronts. But then there's also these ideas of waypoints and deeper in was one of the phrases, community, perseverance. When you take photographs and now have edited them and arranging them in this new book, what's your method? What are the values? What's driving the decision to include this one or that one?
Oh, that's a good one. This book has been 15 years in the making. It's like having sextuplets that you carry for that many years. So it's storytelling. I guess the way to answer that, Peter, and it's a great question, is the heart and soul of this book, which I have working title is Going Deep, is all that I've learned and accumulated here since 1978. And I'm country boy from a little dinky town with no stoplights. Not even, there was one stop sign in Chad's Ford growing up. These little communities, in some cases there are people who are fishing off the same property for 14 generations. There will be 15th generation families before long here. These are such extraordinarily rare places. And what struck me early, what sent me head over heels here, was the character. I mean, there are two characteristics of the coast of Maine. Duh. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. But the far more intriguing, the far more interesting aspect, characteristic of this part of the world, the islands particularly, is the character of community. There still exists in these communities everybody's got everybody else's back. We take care of each other because we've got to. It's lifeboat ethics. Great phrase that somebody else penned. I don't know who originated that, but it is. It's lifeboat ethics. We're in this together. And, the thing on the islands is you all wave to each other off the steering wheel. There's one finger, two finger, come up off the steering wheel is the wave. It's a powerful thing when you don't wave to somebody in an island. And that goes deep. That's Hatfield and McCoy stuff, sometimes going back multiple generations, centuries. And yet, in these communities, if somebody's in trouble, somebody's boat, his boat comes off the mooring, you're right there to help him. Somebody's kid has cancer, or somebody's having a hard time making the payments, or somebody could use an introduction to get this gig or that gig on the island or off the island, on and on and on. People have each other's backs. And I think, without being too overwrought or overblown about it, the United States is so riven these days, is so divided. There's so much animosity and dysfunction. Were it all flipped and were those behaviors to infect these small communities, those communities would be gone in a matter of months. I mean, gone. To flip it, perhaps more positively, less excitedly, I really believe, and this is the heart and soul of this coming book, that there are lessons from which the rest of this country can learn a great deal about getting along, damn it, because we have to.
It's a mental state that I think is organized around a learned system of values.
It is, but it's also survival.
Yes.
Yes, it is mental. You know in your genes, your family's been doing this for, 14, however, 2, 3, 10 generations. But to make it all work, you don't have to love every single person, but you got to make it work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So community, resilience.
Yeah.
Independence.
Sustainability.
Sustainability. Tolerance for human foibles in the sense of maybe not total forgiveness, but understanding. To me, when I use the word mindset, I think it is that people become or learn to think like an island. And so they can think independently as an individual or as a family or as a community or as a physical entity that is separate and self-reliant.
So that's what I've tried to do in this book. I start with, growing up in Chad's Ford and the Wyeth, blah, blah, and then coming to Maine. So it's sort of pilgrim's progress. But then very quickly, it's about what I was seeing, what excited me, this recognition of what is here is truly so extraordinary. And I just go deeper and deeper into that. That's why Andy and Betsy brought me here. Instead of journalism, skimming the surface, going deep. And it's been the privilege of my lifetime to be here and to have been able to go as deep as I have into these communities. I have friends for whom I chop off fingers, and they do the same for me. So this is, what you were talking about, imagery. So I have been so freaking lucky. I've been out there. I'm good with a boat, have a great boat, and been out there for all these years. So much of it is just be there. None of this happens if you're not there. I've really always tried to avoid, like the plague, pretty pictures. The last thing on the planet needed is another book of pretty pictures about the coast of Maine. It's been, and I feel Andy and Betsy, you know, watching me. They're both gone now, but, you know, throughout, telling the real stories, you know, being able to go deep and bear witness to and somehow document the true character of these communities that I are really unique.
You just used a phrase which I think appeals to us all, the privilege of living here.
Amen.
Thank you, Peter.
Peter, thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. My guest today has been Peter Ralston, whose artistic career and inspirational photographs have spanned the coast of Maine and contributed to the understanding and preservation of Maine's working waterfronts and coastal villages as a visual evocation of the spirit of Maine.
Thanks for listening to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. Today, we broadcast the 35th edition of this program. Hard to believe, 3 years of privileged dialogue with some of the most interesting people in Maine, neighbors and friends and observers of the way life has been and should be. I have learned so much from quiet dialogue with these good people, and I trust you have enjoyed their work, as have I. We should be grateful to the public affairs programmers at WERU Community Radio, 89.9 on the FM dial, who welcomed this wild idea and have continued to support the program ever since, providing audio engineering and promotion. To thank them is to support them and make a donation at weru.org/donate. To keep this program on the air with all the great music, news, and commentary that is its unique contribution to our special community. And while you're in that generous frame of mind, why not make a special effort to support your local booksellers, authors, poets, artists, musicians, makers, and arts organizations to keep our creative economy thriving? We never acknowledge the importance of that part of our economy officially as a serious aspect of the quality of life we so enjoy. And finally, if you miss the first Friday of the month afternoon timing for Conversations from the Pointed Firs, you can always listen to archived editions on the WERU website, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at pointedfirs.org and listen to all the 35 interviews at your convenience. Let us know what you like. Suggest interviewees. Be in touch at info.pointedfirs@gmail.com.
This has been Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. Thanks for listening.
You've been tuned in to Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a Leeds Island Books audio project, produced by Tricia Badger, theme by Casey Neal for Mock Turtle Music. Hosted by Peter Neal. Visit pointedfirs.org for more information and find us on your favorite podcast app.